The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
It's too short a time to say anything much. So I'll say as much as I can. And since this is a Insight Meditation Center, I'll talk something about Insight Meditation. Particularly on certain points that are critical to progress. When I started coming to the West, a number of things amazed me, or shall I say surprised me. I will not say about many things that surprised me. One of the things was the yogis in the West were told not to expect. No. We never hear of this in Asia. Not that we don't expect anything. We expect many things, but we were not told not to expect. But I suppose here people expect more. I think expectation comes with hope. And without hope, it's very difficult to strive for anything. So it's not a matter of not expecting or expecting. It's a matter of expecting it in the right way, not too much. Because if we strive and we don't expect for results, I think the striving won't be very strong. Expecting and craving for results are two different things. Yes? So this gives me a reason to give this talk today, which is certain critical points for the progress of insight meditation. Here I will use my experience as an example. Not that I'm going to tell you all the secrets, but I will tell you something. Firstly, like many of you who are not born Buddhist. People look at me as an Asian monk, and so I must be a Buddhist. From birth. No, I wasn't. I'm an ethnic Chinese from Southeast Asia. And we are basically materialists. We have a touch of Confucianism, but really that isn't too much. Secondly, my first language is English. Yes? Because I lived during the early colonial days. The British were the colonial masters of Malaysia at that time. And so from young we were taught to learn in English. We even taught about English history, which has nothing to do with us. My father was a civil servant, so he spoke to us in English. Besides sometimes in Chinese. So I came to Buddhism as a sort of an accident or blunder, because we are all labeled as Buddhists. Anybody who is not a Muslim or Christian or Hindu are Buddhists. Atheists are not unthinkable, or never thought of. And so when I started to discover that I was supposed to be a Buddhist, so I started learning about Buddhism. It was more of curiosity than anything else. Anyway, to cut the story short, I finally ended up doing something like meditation. I started originally with Zen. Not the Zen that most people know of. It's more of the Chinese Chan. You know? And to make another story short, I also ended up as a Theravada monk. To us, during those days, it didn't really matter which type of Buddhism you came under. Buddhism was Buddhism to us. Now, when I was studying the Zen under the Chinese master, I did get results. No? And that was basically what that made me decide to try being a monk. Yes? I don't suppose you are too interested in all the small details. Actually, it's my reason to going straight to the point. What happened is, although I did get experiences, genuine experiences under the Chinese Zen, when I came to Theravada Buddhism, Vipassana, I found I took to it quite easily. This was because of the British education. They are also quite structured. Zen, I found, was quite unstructured. In fact, a little bit lost. The teacher says something to you and you get very aware of some things that are going to do with your existence. Something like that. So when I took up the Vipassana, everything, the Theravadan, also very structured and very analytical. And so I took it to it happily. Now, when I started taking to it, I started to pinpoint, and the emphasis was on mindfulness. I'm sure you have heard of that umpteen times. So, when I heard about this mindfulness, I began to ask, what is mindfulness? You know? And so I started digging into whatever texts I could get in English. Many, unfortunately, weren't very clear. You know? For example, the characteristic, lakana, of sati. No, first they talk about sati as to remember, which does not seem quite right to me. No. Then it started, the characteristic is plunging onto the object as a plug that sinks into the water. Then I thought, this also doesn't make too much sense to me. It sounds like concentration. And so one after another, the manifestation is coming face to face with the object. Again, it doesn't really hit a bell. Anyway, I picked up whatever I can and made sense and went on from there. This has something to do with my Chinese background. Because a Chinaman is basically a pragmatic person. When you come to meditate a Chinaman, you don't give him all that philosophical and theoretical crap. You tell him what to do. If it works, he'll follow you. If it doesn't, forget it. That was the China man in me. So I took to it, And somehow it worked somewhere. And I went on from there. But later, after coming one big round, I discovered that actually it is a very important point. It's a starting point. But fortunately, in my case, I had good teachers. You know, when I needed the right teachers, they were there. So the first important factor, I think, in the progress of the practice is having your basics right. The basic techniques, the basic understanding right. Many people have started, I could have been me, gone on the wrong track from the very start. For example, this mindfulness is not so easy, so I don't blame myself. Because it is a state of mind. And their mindfulness takes different forms. You know? And mindfulness is an experience, not words. You know? How do you point to an experience with words? It can only give you a right rough guide. Right? So from the very start, I tell people what I think is this mindfulness. And this is usually given in the beginning of a Vipassana retreat. And I tell them the first thing you must get your mindfulness right, which is right mindfulness. I'm playing with words, sorry. Which is pure presence. To be totally and completely present. And when you're completely present, you have also right concentration. Concentration basically is a total involvement of the mind in a certain direction. Yeah? Sometimes they use the word object for that direction. But if you use it as a pure mental state, it's a total involvement of the consciousness at the present. Okay? Don't think who is present. Don't think what is present. Yeah? Just be completely present. I think if you can get that idea right on the point, you're getting the right method. Because all other methods and skills and techniques revolve around this. The reason being, reality or truth is here and now. Even when you say here and now, it's also a concept. What is here, what is now, you can ask. You know? You say whatever is present is here and now. Right? So that's basically what mindfulness. And according to the teachings of the Buddha, if you realize what in reality is truth, there's no ignorance. And from that, all the other causes of suffering are not there. And the way to perfect peace is right there. Right? It's as simple as that. It's too simple. I suppose that's why the earlier commentators did not say too much, because it was too simple. You cannot be simpler. So they said, you see, when you're totally present, you know, and totally involved, you're totally plunged in whatever there is. And when they say the object of vipassana, which is a reality. And when you're totally, completely present, you come face to face with reality. And that's a vipassana object. It's just a matter of being totally present. Yeah. And if you say, I must be present, that's the first step. But you must not even think of present. The present itself is a concept of time. After all, what is present, you tell me. So that is the basic first idea of vipassana. All other techniques revolve around that. Now the second thing to remember in this basic technique is the next thing around this total presence is the wholesomeness. The wholesomeness of this consciousness. That means it is void of, there is no delusion, there is no craving, aversion, and all the negative states. There are these basic wholesome qualities of peace, clarity, and gentleness or softness. And one is totally present with reality, this automatically comes up. This second level we call it kusala in Pali, wholesome, wholesome and unwholesome. Yes? It's basic quality. Now this has an important implication, because many techniques, if you just follow it literally or mechanically, it goes into an unwholesome state of consciousness. So this second wholesome state is an important part. And it is this part which most teachers start with. Because the first step is too simple, too direct. So you have the second step. Once you take one or couple of steps back. And so, what is mindfulness? Mindfulness is clear awareness. Clear, peaceful awareness of what is going on, what you are doing here and now. So what are you doing? And so you have the basic meditation objects. Rising, falling, sitting, touching, in, out, and all that. You know? And how to bring it there and watch it continuous. And when you go watch, have a continuous mindfulness, you bring it closer and closer to the reality of the here and now. Or the timeless reality, to be more accurate. Yes? I don't have time to talk all the truths in detail. Yes? But generally, I give you that in the sense that to get your techniques right, you know, the principles right. Different traditions have their approach of dealing with the matter. Once this, often somebody will ask me, Bhante, is vipassana the only way to realization? I said, yes. Then they're not happy. Yeah? Because they think vipassana is just watching rising and falling. Then I qualify my statement. I said, vipassana means realization. You're asking, is the way of practicing to get realization the way to realization? Of course. No. I mean, it's not the question, but generally that's what I wanted to point out. All the techniques which are correct should bring about realization. Right? It doesn't matter which tradition you come from. You can be Theravada, you can be Zen, you can be Dzogchen or whatever, Tibetan. You know? They all should come to the same, because there's only one truth, one reality. There aren't too many of them. It's either it's real or not. If it's not real, then it's not. If it's real, it's real. Simple as that. Then, so when I started practicing, the next thing that gave me the extra progress is intensive retreats. Well, I've heard of it. The first time I heard of these monasteries, they wake up at 4 o'clock, 3 o'clock. It's frightening. You have to meditate the whole day, from morning to night. Yeah? But being young and enthusiastic and idealistic, it was not an obstacle. So I went for it. Wow, there's such a thing in Malaysia itself. I'm going for it. So I went for it. You know? It isn't as difficult as you would think, you know. When everybody is doing it, you can do it. Once I started, I was trying out with a few people who are more experienced, not very experienced, maybe. So I started a program of 2 hours sitting. 1 hour walking, 2 hours sitting. 1 hour walking, 2 hours sitting. No problem. Even for certain people who are quite new, also no problem. When everybody sat for 2 hours, they sat for 2 hours. A little more pain, perhaps. But it was okay. The mind could take it. But usually, they go 1 hour, 1 hour. Here they do 45 minutes. But what is important is the continuity of the practice. There are certain factors that are helpful. You know, in daily life, you know, you go and meditate and go back, and 1,001 things will bother you, and you start again. I would not say that there is no progress. Usually, I notice people still progress fairly well and far if they are what we call the die-harders. That means, whatever happens, they'll sit. Even they're half sick and half dead, they'll sit. No, they're very regular. Day by day, they sit. No end. And you can, after a while, you can see steady progress in the insights development. Other than that, I think most people need to go for retreats, intensive retreats, because of the continuity, firstly. Because one of the what you call the factors which is lacking in daily life is the concentration. The mind needs to be concentrated, that means clear and open without any thinking for a while to realize what's going underneath. Otherwise all the thinking and the concepts you cannot see properly. So it has to be completely open and clear to see what is happening. And this is often, especially for beginners, possible only during intensive retreats. After that, then when you go back to daily life, it can still go on. Now, secondly, is during intensive retreats, there is this close guidance. Ideally, the interviews are held every day. You know, many things happen to you in 24 hours. When you sit so many hours, many things happen to you. And often you don't get much time for interviews. We try to give 10 minutes. Sometimes they only can afford to give you 5 minutes. Now 5 minutes is insufficient to say all that is happening in all those hours. But you can summarize. But imagine if this is happening and you don't get any interviews once, only get once a week. So how much guidance do you have? And at the beginning, you really need some guidance. You notice that many people think they can get everything from books. I suppose you can get quite a bit, but many of things are still in the oral tradition. And especially with experiences, how do you describe an experience? Especially an experience that you have not come across before. It's more effective one-to-one. When the teacher interviews you, generally he knows your state of mind and what's happening. This is generally accepted in Asia, but in the West sometimes because people rely a lot on books. Yes? It's very strange. At one time I was in Houston and there was in this temple, I was holding some retreats there, and this man who came to the temple and says, I said, "Do you go to retreats?" He said, "Retreats? I don't go for retreats. It's not necessary to go for retreats. People go to retreats because they want to socialize." And that's what he said. Besides, he said, you look at it, he borrowed a few thick books. All the great masters have said what they want to say in these books. So why do I need to go for retreats? It's a bit arrogant, I think. But it's not without reason. So I think retreats are very important. It makes a big difference. Then there are other matters. Tentative. I'm always short. I should stop at 10, isn't it? Oh, 10:45. Okay, I still have some time. Now, in the tradition I came in, and probably many of you are also allied to the tradition, the Mahasi tradition. They use the four foundations of mindfulness, Satipatthana. And so it's called Satipatthana Vipassana. Insight meditation based on the four foundations of mindfulness. I think this is a very good tradition, very start, very especially for beginners, and most people are still beginners. Because it starts with a very strong emphasis on the body foundation of mindfulness. Yeah? Rising, falling, sitting, touching, breath, walking, all these are body foundation of mindfulness. The important thing of the importance of the body foundation is strong grounding. Generally, when we teach the body foundation of mindfulness, when you naturally, sooner or later, would come into the other foundations, feelings, consciousness, and mental objects. Yes. And when a person embarks on the body foundation of mindfulness, how the mental development takes place, we know. It's like a first test when you go into the medic and you go to the hospital to take your blood and all those things. The first trial, you see, we know how your mind responds. Because from there, the seeds and fundamentals of the other foundations are also found connected with it. And so, you can be led to the development of the other foundations when you have the aptitude. But sooner or later, all the foundations have to be developed. Yes. There are also other traditions that teach other foundations. For example, they teach more on feelings, more on consciousness. They are more specialists in that sense. But I find that if a person is not really grounded in the body foundations of mindfulness, it's very difficult to progress otherwise, because it connects to your daily life. It connects to everything. But once one has reached that foundation level, then one should expand on the other foundations. Now, many of people in the tradition are watching a lot on body and feelings. They don't go too much into consciousness. So when I started going into this in Malaysia, our Theravadan school there is also can be as conservative. So when I started teaching about consciousness, they asked me, "Who taught you to teach like this? We never learned this from our sadhus." Things like that happen. I said, "Well, the Buddhas taught it." And this is also another very interesting field. The body foundations is the grounding and the base. The feelings is the foundations of what? Emotional happiness. Although what feelings, the starting is, the introduction is pain. Not very nice. But when you get more into the foundation of feelings, you develop mastery of the feelings. You can be happy whenever you want. You can change, transform pain and whatever into pleasant things. Things like that. That's the foundation of feelings. And because of that, concentration deepens. Life becomes very pleasant because they have discovered the fountain of joy. That's a feeling foundation of life. So don't be turned back by pain. It's just the beginning. But when you go to consciousness, then you meet with the boss. Because Buddhism, we said, mind is the forerunner of all states. All are mind-made and created. You know? So actually it is the most strategic in the terms of meditation techniques to reach up to the foundation of consciousness. Because everything in our practice, everything in our experience are connected to consciousness. You know? So if you reach to there, then you get to the boss, the key that connects everything. You know? And so you discover how this consciousness works. Because the whole of meditation is about consciousness. What else? Mental development, mental cultivation, even the happiness and suffering are all mental, as people know it. So I started working on this different, because people don't tell too much, books don't tell too much. The most I got are from the suttas. You know? So I always go back. It's the same thing that I read, but every time I read, there's new discoveries. But there's something that came along which gave me another extra lift. This is the study of the Abhidhamma, the Buddhist metaphysics. Fortunately for me, my meditation teacher is also an Abhidhamma scholar. And so he taught us Abhidhamma. For example, in 1 hour talk, he will just give the talk on one consciousness. And he gives the whole hour all on that consciousness, for example. And because there are 89 consciousness, so it takes quite a while before we go through all that. So when I started learning into the consciousness, you know, we know this is theoretical. Even some people say this is not a Buddha's word. But let me say that this has been endorsed by the Sangha, by the entire Theravada Sangha. So it is something that is worth seriously considering. We don't just wipe it out because it is not in the suttas or it's what, later century or something like that. No, it's still. And from the practice, many things can be validated. No? But more important that it gives you many clues to the deeper aspects and finer aspects of the practice. I'm still slowly discovering more and more things. Because, you look, it is highly structured. It is like, it has classified everything in the universe in little square holes. And there's nothing left for you to put anything in. But if you study closely, there are loopholes. Why are these loopholes there? Then you started discovering there is something deeper besides what they say. And so where is the best place to find out? This is your meditation. So you look at the consciousness. Because you study consciousness, mental states, and you meditate, you automatically look at them. And if you are curious, you look deeper into them. And so it becomes a whole avenue for further discovery in Vipassana. Yes? And after that, you go into Dhammanupassana. Dhammanupassana, I would call the highest form of vipassana. That means the essence of vipassana is in Dhammanupassana. As before, when I read all these things, I said, what is Dhammanupassana? The common translation is mindfulness of mental objects. Now, that is, again, something I didn't quite ring a bell. Because the word Dhamma has many meanings. Right? Then I think, well, when you talk of mental objects, everything can be a mental object. Fair enough. But so what? No. It seems to me more like a search for a word that suits the translation rather than the practical application as it is meant to bring about. Yes. Then one day I read a book. It's a Thai book. And it talks about the four foundations. Then he hit a note. He says, Dharma here does not... He says, Dharma here means natural truth, phenomena. Hmm? Like, it's just as I had learned in the Abhidharma, Dharma, ni sattu, ni jivo, sunyo. Not the being, not the soul, emptiness. And they describe it according to the fourfold analysis. Its characteristics, its function, its proximate, its manifestation, and its proximate cause. All phenomena are analyzed, defined, identified in that way. For example, your teacher, how does he know your teacher? Because you teach. Your function is to teach. And people have seen you teaching. Something like that. So the characteristics are natural phenomena like anger, like greed, like mindfulness, like concentration. All these are natural phenomena, including hardness, softness, heat, and so on. All these are natural phenomena. And it says that is the actual meaning of Dhammanupassana, meditation on phenomena. Then it rings a bell. Because it gives you the practical aspect of it. And when you study Abhidharma or this phenomenon, it tells clearly about this non-self, which is a natural truth. Many often people give a negative definition of non-self, anatta, no self. A is a negative prefix. Atta means self, so no self. They translate that way. It gives you what it is not, but it doesn't tell you what it is. So you are left with an empty space, and something else may fall into the empty space, which may not be correct, you know. That's usually what happens. So I find the more correct thing is Dhamma, which is natural truth, natural phenomena. You know, when you have no concepts, no ideas, things are there whether you like it or not. It is there. And so I use that as the meaning of Dhammanupassana, which means contemplation of natural truths, which of course include everything when you have this right mindfulness in all its depths. From the first level, we call it the Paramatta Dhammas, ultimate realities. Again, this is so misnominal. It shouldn't be ultimate. It's not ultimate. Only one of them, Nibbana, is ultimate. The rest are not ultimate. The rest are non-conceptual experiences, to be more correct, phenomena. And so, as you practice on, it goes deeper into their deeper natures, which again we say is impermanent, suffering, non-self, which very often you see is also a negative definition. This deeper aspect is understandable because no words can describe it. Any words that I use, I find are more instructive rather than definitive. Yes? So anyway, so Abhidhamma has this important aspect of lifting up one's practice and understanding one's practice to for progress into the citta and the Dhamma. 45. One more thing. Now, after some years in Asia, I came to the West, started teaching. Not that I came to teach. I came as an escape. I fled from responsibilities. In Asia, the movement is very strong. When I became a monk, it just started. My teacher started the movement there. And by now, it is a lot of people. So I was teaching from morning to night. I hardly had time to go to the toilet. Yes? And so I didn't become a monk to do all this. I don't mind teaching and sharing what I know, but this is too much. It defeats the life of a monk. So I fled. And Europe, I had some friends in Australia, but it was too near. Because all you need is a ticket and you go there. So I have to fly across the Himalayas. Not many people know places in Europe. For me, I know one or two friends. So I started with my small groups, and mainly because I could meditate most of the time. Of course, it's increasing now. So I fled. You know? And of course, as a monk, teaching is part of the profession. If you can call it a profession. Can you call it a profession? Mm-hmm. It's part of his life. If people ask you something, what do you say? You don't talk about television shows. You talk about the Dharma, right? But sometimes, once in a while you do, if people ask. But I haven't seen television for a long time, so I can't say much. So, anyway. So, now, when you come to the West, it's a different kettle of fish. It's quite a mixed pot. Because in Asia, it's quite... I wouldn't like to use the word sectarian. You know, people in certain strict groups, and they go deep into the practice. Does not mean that they hate the other groups, although some do. But it does not mean. It means that they're very involved with their form of practice. Yeah? Now when they come to the West, there are many groups. There are Zen groups, there are Tibetan groups, there are don't know what, there's Osho groups also. I don't know whether Osho groups are still here. There's so many other groups. So when you talk to a group, you know, there's so many people and so many other, and especially when you teach meditation, they all come from all types of people. And I go to so many countries, which further makes it more varied. So when you try to teach the people, you try to teach them as from where they are, you know, their understanding, their culture, and so on. And so this becomes quite interesting for me. It's quite... I forgot the word for it. Getting old. Quite refreshing. I don't have to use the old ways of dealing with the matter. And besides, people are more individualistic. So you treat each individual with a certain specific method. There, sometimes they are quite homogeneous. I sit there, a whole lot of them. One come, I'm like a factory in a factory, you know. Okay, after listening, something wrong with you. Twist you a bit. Okay, next. Twist a bit. Next. Because they're quite homogeneous and they're quite standard. Once in a while, you're an oddball. That livens me up. Ah, what's this? But here, people are quite different, so... quite different. So, this makes me feel... But it is possible, because the Dhamma transcends all these cultures. The reality and truth transcends all the cultures. All you need to do is speak in their terms and their language. And so you find that it's able to reach to these people and they can progress in the vipassana, you know, in the meditation, whatever you call it. Now this has also a benefit for me itself. Because, you know, when we used to one thing for a long time, there are a lot of dogmas and things which are put in, like the institution, which are not wrong. No, it's not wrong. It's more often more for the safety of the beginners. But they are there for so long and you take them for granted. And in the when you go further, they become actually barriers. No? Because you take them as just word for word. But later, with all these things coming out, my mind became more opened. And so, it's able to see more of the path as it is, not as a path strictly outlined by any tradition. And I find this is also very important. And this I get only when I came over to Europe, where I did a lot of meditation by myself in the Swiss mountains and things like that. So there is this very important basic quality for improvement, which is important from the very beginning. A few things. First, insatiable curiosity. There is something that I have. No, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. If this is what I'm about, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. Secondly is, which means that you're always, one thing important, because always you must be looking for them. If you see something, what's more? What's more? You must keep looking up. This one very important. Second, connected with this, is the willingness to transcend and go beyond. You know? Many people are very locked up in their little secure world. You know? And so it's difficult for them to let go. For example, after some time, there's a further step going. It's like going into unknown territory. You don't know what's going to happen in your mind. You know? And so there has to be a degree of, which I call it, the faith in the beyond. Then third is openness. And this is difficult. We think we are open, but actually often we are not. There are so many things in our mind that, yes, we are open, we are not thinking, but they are there. The barriers are there. And just give you an example. No, this is not example actually in the meditation, but something like that. When I first came to Europe, now I'm resident in Europe, about over 8 years ago. Because of all these things and so much work down there, I escaped for my first time to Europe. And after 3 weeks of meditation, I said, I don't have to go back. Why should I go back? I don't need to go back, so I'm not going back. No, you see, sometimes the things they put into you, you have to go back, you have your responsibility, you have all these things. And I don't have to go back. I can carry on here. So, you know, it's just that idea of the certain things that are limiting you. And once you take them off, the whole new world opens to you. So meditation also the same. There are many things that are blocking our views and we don't know it. Take for one example maybe, you know, when you meditate, people often have a sense of I there. You know? Sometimes they don't think that when I meditate, no, I don't have a sense of I, but it's there. But once you start recognizing this more subtle presence of a sense of I or ego, it blocks. You know? But once you recognize it, the blockage is removed. And then you go to a completely new phase of experience. Take just one example. I think I will stop here. Thank you. I've always short my time. Yes. Maybe I have one question. I have a friend in Malaysia that used to come. He dressed like, who used to dress a bit strange, you know? He's an elderly man, but his trousers up to here. Rather short, because it's rather short, you know, so he wears his trousers up. We call him a Malay woman. Because a Malay woman usually wears the sarong up to here when they bathe. So he always come around, Master, one question. After that, he goes around a few hours and comes back with one question. So I asked him one question. Yes.
I was thinking about the first three fetters, and one of them is letting go of ethical, or if I understand it, the ethical practices and something. And sometimes I feel like that gets in the way when I'm too like, oh, I can't do this because that's. But then there's. I was just thinking about when those things actually become a blockage, because I do feel like sometimes I'm grasping on to ethics, where I'm wondering what that process is like, or whether the ethics of. Are these really the ethical principles that I'm adhering to for wholesomeness, or are they institutional things? That's been a very difficult.
Yes, you should question. You should question. Yes, yes. So everything is questioned in vipassana. Even your own mindfulness and your own reality, everything is questioned. But you also need to have some faith, because too much questioning gets skeptical doubts. You must have enough faith as well to try out. But more important, the questioning is not skeptical. The questioning is to find out why and what. When I first went to Burma that time, it's still very traditional. And so the teachers generally are authoritative. They're authoritative teachers. So I was brought up in the Malaysia, British education. We are a strange, a freak. Because outside we are Asians. Only, but inside we question, what is he doing? They bow in front of the monks, at the back they laugh at them. What is he doing? He's a monk. But inside they go like that. But I have enough common sense to try out longer. So, yours is not the reason why. Yours is but to do and die. So I didn't die, but I tried. I would live before I die. So, anyway, after studying with them for some time, I found out they have reasons for saying certain things. It's just that, they don't feel that it's time for you to understand that yet. So, eventually I understood that. And that's why I started writing some of my first books in Vipassana. Because there are enough why people, the why type of people in Malaysia. So, that became generally the basic text they use in Malaysia for Vipassana practices. Because I started seeing why we do this, why we do this. If you question to the reason why, and you know that it's valid, you follow it. The only trouble is, you may need somebody to, if you can't find out, you may need somebody to tell you. And sometimes you always can't find somebody to tell you. Suppose there are enough people here, teachers, to tell you the basics. Yes? Okay. Thank you. Sorry, I don't have time. I have another group there. And I have to fly back tomorrow.